Statistics tell us that 1 in 5 teens has experienced depression at some point in their lives. But depression and anxiety, the most common mental health issues, look quite different from the adult versions of these disorders. So how do we know if our child or teen is depressed or just moody, and if they need help? Well, joining us this morning with some answers is Dr. Terry Hargrave, an assistant professor of child and adolescent psychiatry in the Department of Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Hargrave. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for allowing me the opportunity to speak to the community.
So first help us understand, what does child and adolescent depression look like, and how is it different from depression in adults?
The major difference is that it doesn't always look sad. Sometimes it looks anxious, sometimes it looks irritable, and sometimes it looks like a bad boy or a bad girl who is just not behaving the way that they formerly behaved.
How can parents recognize some of these behaviors as being depression then?
Associated features.
Like
change in appetite, like poor sleep, like decline in school performance. Those would be some of the associated things. Not wanting to be around their friends, just not seeming to get sustained pleasure out of activities that they formerly enjoyed. Somatic symptoms is another one, headaches, stomach aches.
How about things like fatigue?
Sometimes that is that as well, low energy, and not always associated with a sleep disturbance. It can be too much sleep as well as too little sleep.
So you were saying that, I was actually made the comment that 1 in 5 teens has had depression and or anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other mental health issues those are only two of the kinds of mental health issues that you see in children and adolescents. Are there others?
The four big ones, which I call the four horsemen or women of pediatric mental health, are ADHD, mm-hmm. depression, anxiety disorders, and behavioral health issues.
And what fits into the behavioral health issues, and how is that different, for example?
That's a whole family of anything that is not what the parents and society would like it to be.
Okay. In other words, they're not quite fitting into our cultural mandates and norms.
And it can be for a variety of different reasons.
Yeah.
And usually behavior is not just behavior for behavior's sake. It's behavior that has a purpose, or behavior that's coming from an inner state, or behavior that's triggered by the environment, behavior that's triggered by prior experience and hearing shark music as opposed to soothing tones from some trigger in the environment.
Interesting. Well, we'll get a little bit into kind of the origins of some of this, but tell me a little bit about children versus adolescents. I mean, we often hear that adolescents are subject to these kinds of mood changes. I mean, it kind of goes with the territory as you reach adolescence, all those surging hormones, all those developmental changes coming about. But we also know that that depression and anxiety can strike children as well. Does it look different in children?
It looks less often sad, although it can look sad. Adolescents are a little bit better at identifying and have vocabulary and world experience that would let them say, I feel sad. Younger children may not be able to identify their emotions quite as well. And sadness can be called, well, I'm mad, or I'm scared.
So that basically you're saying that there's a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
And that it really is, the symptoms are somewhat similar, but maybe they don't have the cognitive ability to recognize and name certain mm-hmm. aspects of how they're feeling.
And they may talk less about it and do. They may translate their feelings into some sort of action.
So there's more acting out, perhaps, or
acting in.
Or acting in, like being
just withdrawn. The other difference, major difference, is that boys are as often affected as girls prepubertally. That changes with puberty such that girls are twice as often presenting with depression as boys.
That's very interesting. Why do you think that is?
To some extent, it's the socialization of girls to act in as opposed to act out. And boys do as opposed to they do.
That's interesting because it sounds like, you know, in some ways, it's not a new idea. I mean, the idea is that girls are not given permission to be, quote unquote, boys will be boys kind of thing, and girls are not allowed. They have to be prim and proper and a million things these days. They have to be everything and all things to all people. But are you suggesting that in that case society is playing the bigger role?
Well, I'm not sure I'm able to answer that question with data that says it's any one thing or the other. It's multifactorial, and some of it is likely to be biologically based, and others more culturally based.
Very interesting, but clearly the culture does play a role.
Culture does, culture plays a role in the devil is often in the details of the cultural experience in terms of understanding what's going on in a family, what's going on with a child.
Right. I think that's very insightful. I'm going to ask you to hold that thought, and we're going to take a very short break, and we'll be right back with more HealthLink on Air and more from Dr. Terry Hargrave right after this short break. Dr. Terry Hargrave, child psychiatrist, and we're talking about child and adolescent depression. Right before the break, we were talking about, who's at risk for this kind of thing. We were talking about boys and girls, gender issues. What are some of the other factors that play a role in terms of who might end up with depression as a child or an adolescent?
I'm going to back us up even to what is the biopsychosocial model for conceptualization of any mental health issue, depression being a common one. And the bio piece of it has to do with one's genetics. What's the family history? There are families in which depression is very common, families where bipolar depression is common, where schizophrenia is common, where ADHD is common, where anxiety is common. And where acting out behavior and conduct disorder are common. And there's a genetic portion of that, not well identified in terms of where on the genome it sits, but certainly in doing a family history. A pediatrician, for example, in taking a mental health history in addition to a physical health history when a child enters their practice, is likely to be able to have a risk profile, a mental health risk profile, evident from the beginning.
And in addition to that, I mean, so we're talking about nature, this idea of nature, nurture, there's nature. But there are also the potential for stressful events in a child's life, so the nurture part can play a role.
Starting with the prenatal experience, including how planned was the pregnancy, what's the mother's experience during the pregnancy, what stress hormones did the woman have going during the pregnancy, exposure to substances, all of that. And then once the child is born, the quality of the mother's emotional health, depression is, and other mental health issues are more common in infants who have mothers who are depressed and who are unable to meet their faces with a smile, to note their signals. And you can take it from there in terms of environmental stressors,
So there's a tremendous amount of interaction and factors that right. is multifactorial, which is what you said before.
Right. And the science of it says that genes are turned on and turned off by what happens to us. The whole field of epigenetics is stellar. Mm-hmm. It's where it's at in terms of understanding how we become adults, both in our psyches and in our bodies.
So as a parent, how do you know, because I think this is kind of a key question that has to come up, when your child has some of these behavioral attributes that we were talking about before, they may not even be acting out, and they may not even be sad, but some of this loss of appetite, or they won't get out of bed, or, you know, a number of these things, they don't want to go to school, they don't seem to take pleasure, some of those issues that you raised before. How do you know if it's depression or it's just that they're being moody? I mean, kids, when they hit adolescence, often change in their reactions to their parents and their reactions to their friends. How do you know that it's something that needs real attention, professional attention, or they won't just grow out of it? And what's the potential for ignoring it? I mean, what's the potential downside or consequence of ignoring it?
Okay, that's lots of questions.
Okay,
all at once.
Go ahead.
Let's start with the one of when do you start to worry? When it goes on, and for depression, it's sort of defined as 2 weeks of symptoms. For the depressive disorder of dysthymia, it's a much longer time than that. And the other is function. Is there a decline in function? Is there a significant disturbance of the child's ability to be part of their school system, be part of their family system? Are they able to take care of themselves? What's the decline in function? If a kid is sad for a little while but is basically carrying on with life and does well in school, sleeps okay at night, or there has to be some disability associated with it.
One of the big fears, I think, associated with childhood depression, or more so adolescent depression, is this whole notion of suicide.
Mm.
So clearly, if it seems to me that's got to be kind of the sword of Damocles hanging over the head of a parent, if they fear this is what's going on with the child, I mean the depression, and they don't take action. Has that been your experience as well?
Certainly suicidality, and that's the big one that one wants to prevent.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes the child won't be upfront about it, but may talk about wishing they weren't alive, wishing that they'd never been born. It's much more significant if that sort of statement happens when a child isn't aroused. When a kid is having a temper tantrum or is really upset, it's not uncommon to say, well, I wish I were dead, or I'd like to kill myself, or why don't you just kill me?
Mm-hmm.
But it's more of a, that's to be paid attention to as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it's far more significant if it's on a more ongoing, pervasive sort of issue.
Yeah. So it seems to me that treatment is clearly a problem in our community, or it seems to me it's a pervasive issue in terms of not that there aren't treatment modalities available, whether it be talk therapy or medications, but the accessibility for those kinds of treatments is a problem. Is that your experience?
It's a major problem throughout the country. The studies show that only about one in five even fewer kids that have mental health issues ever receive treatment for them. And only a small fraction of those are actually seen in the professional community. And that has to do with the availability of child psychiatrists. And will never be enough of them, given what it takes to train to become a child psychiatrist.
And you're involved in an initiative right here in our community, and you said it's actually a statewide initiative to make a dent in that or to make a change in that. Tell us about that.
I am proud to talk about the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Program for Primary Care, which is a program that's funded at present by a grant from the Office of Mental Health, the State Office of Mental Health, and designed in collaboration with the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Academy of Family Practice, and the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry.
And what does it hope to accomplish?
To enable primary care physicians to better assess and manage mild to moderate mental health issues with their patients, with those big four that I talked about before.
So the fact is that that's usually the first line of defense. I mean, children go to their pediatricians, and even adolescents continue to go to their pediatricians. So the pediatrician has a special role to play here. I'm talking about now the general pediatrician, to recognize, as you said, taking a family history and maybe recognize the potential for that at-risk child, but also then to actually get involved in treatment.
Yes, that's our hope, is to enable primary care physicians to feel more comfortable in their own practices, because oftentimes the depression and anxiety disorders in childhood fall in the mild to moderate range. However, if they're not attended to and paid attention to, they really have the potential to kindle further episodes and to evolve into significant chronic adult pathology.
We're running out of time, and I want to make sure that you get a chance to tell us, is this working? Are you reaching out to pediatricians? Are more
we are
getting on board here?
Yes, we are. There is a 9-to-5 daily phone line, which primary care doctors have access to have a consult within 2 hours with a child psychiatrist from the academic faculties, either Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, Columbia, or Long Island Jewish.
Wow.
And if the issue can't be solved over the phone, there's the potential for a face-to-face consultation on a one-time basis. We have a website, and I'd like to give everybody this website, because there's resources for primary care providers.
We'll be able to link to that, so you don't even have to go through that. But because we're running out of time, I just want to make sure that your feeling now is that we are really reaching pediatricians to take an active role.
We are working on it.
Well, I can't thank you enough for coming in and telling us all about this. It is a very serious concern in our community. It's a serious concern in general for parents these days. It is a common problem, but we feel hopeful with what you've told us so far today. Dr. Terry Hargrave, child psychiatrist and pediatrician, thanks for coming in. We'll be right back after the news with a different controversial topic, actually, the HPV vaccine, and we'll get the record straight about that. I'm Linda Cohen. This is FM News Radio 106.9 and 570 WSYR.